Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable. It's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
We made this.
Hi, everybody. Carl here. Just wanted to let you know that today's episode was recorded not for the Movie Palace originally, but for the Movieversaries podcast. Movieversaries is another show on the We Made This network. I was absolutely delighted to join host Bo Nicholson to discuss Charlie Chaplin's City Lights, which has reached its 90th anniversary. So, as the name suggests, Movieversaries is a podcast that's all about celebrating great films once they reach a significant milestone. So if you like what you hear on this episode, please consider subscribing to Bo's show. He's released episodes so far on Spirited Away, which is now 20 years old, and on Walkabout, which is 50, and I know there's other great stuff in the pipeline too. If you're curious to know more, follow the We Made This account on Twitter, where you'll be able to find further details. So that's at WMT_network, or you can go to WeMadeThisNetwork.com. Finally, I'd like to thank Bo for editing this episode, and without further ado, let's get on with the show.
Before Will Ferrell and Steve Carell, there was Adam Sandler and Jim Carrey. Before them, Eddie Murphy. Before him, Woody Allen. Before him, Jerry Lewis. Before him, well before him, was Charlie Chaplin. Born in April 1889, literally the same week as Adolf Hitler, who he would later lampoon in The Great Dictator, Chaplin was cinema's first great star. Sure, people were making movies before him, and yes, he had his contemporaries, but no one was able to hold a candle to the sheer force of Chaplin's celebrity in the formative years of cinema. A writer, director, pantomime actor, composer, and co-founder of United Artists, Chaplin was a force of nature. His character, the Tramp, was said to be the most recognizable image on the planet, due to his films being able to successfully cross international borders thanks to them being silent, and his unmistakable skill. But he was a complex character. He had a lot to say behind the seeming naivety of the Tramp. His was a mind imbued with bottomless creativity, and his feature-length films gave him the perfect canvas on which to communicate his vision. He had made masterpieces before City Lights, but many regard it to be his greatest film. Deceptively simple, yet painstakingly created, it has multiple scenes that have stood the test of time, sandwiched between the statue at the beginning and that ending, the one that never failed to dampen my eyes. Made in 1931, the era of talking films, City Lights was proof of Chaplin's genius, that he could still captivate audiences without the bells and whistles of modern filmmaking, and, despite being old-fashioned, it probably has aged better than any film made in the same year. An ode to the transformative power of love by a man after a breakup, City Lights is one of the greatest comedies ever made, and today we celebrate its 90th movieversary. We'll be right back.
Welcome to Movieversaries, an official We Made This podcast network show. I'm your host, Bo Nicholson. Movieversaries is a show where we celebrate the anniversaries of some of the greatest films ever made. On this episode, we're discussing City Lights, Charlie Chaplin's stubborn resistance to join the talkie movement that became his magnum opus on its 90th anniversary. To help me discuss the film, I'm actually very, very excited to be joined by the host of the Movie Palace, Carl Sweeney. Carl, I'm a bit of a fan of the Movie Palace, and I'm very, very happy to have you here to talk about Charlie Chaplin's great film, City Lights.
No, I think the pleasure is all mine, Bo. I'm really looking forward to this. It's great to be on an early episode of your show. Big thanks for having me, really.
Now, this sort of falls very much into your wheelhouse, because on the Movie Palace, I've noticed that you like to talk about a lot of older films, particularly from the 1930s and a couple of decades onwards from there. Being 1931, I imagine this is a film you're well familiar with.
Yeah, I've seen this film a few times. I suppose in terms of the Movie Palace, we haven't done that much on the podcast, and it's my fault, it's my oversight. We haven't done that much about silent film. And of course, the interesting thing with City Lights, as you've already alluded to, is it's kind of oddly situated, isn't it, in 1931. And it's not purely silent. You've got a recorded score. There are some sound effects and things. So I'm really looking forward to discussing it for that reason too, that I haven't done as much podcasting about Chaplin or silent films in general as I would have liked, you know.
Well, maybe this could be the start of something very, very special. A beautiful friendship, if you will.
I believe so.
I can throw another old movie in there.
Yeah.
It is, of course, made about 4 years after talking film started. Of course, the very famous The Jazz Singer in 1927, which basically became one of the most influential films ever. And City Lights is Charlie Chaplin, as I said, very stubbornly sort of sticking to that pantomime style. He does obviously compose the score for this film, like you mentioned. There are sounds added in post-production, but it was, as a stubborn person myself, I can really respect what Charlie Chaplin's going about here.
Yeah, I think so, because when you consider the context of, you know, after Chaplin had done the circus, you know, that transition to sound happened during the shooting of City Lights, that really the American cinema was abandoning silent films. I believe there had been some talk early on that there would be potentially even like a silent version of the film that would go out and a sound version. But I think Chaplin then decided he was kind of dead against the inclusion of dialogue. He felt that talkies were spoiling, you know, what he called the oldest art in the world, i.e. pantomime. So it was a calculated risk, wasn't it? And you can understand, I admire it too, like you say. I think a calculated risk, but one I'm very glad he took.
And a big risk indeed. We will get into the production side of things very shortly. I suppose we should mention that this is a spoiler podcast, Movieversary. So, I mean, not that there's much to spoil, really. I wouldn't say that plot is the strongest part of this film, but it's basically the story of the little tramp, as Charlie Chaplin played in most of his movies, really, some iteration of the tramp. And he falls in love with a blind flower girl who seems to sort of be quite fond of him as well. She mistakes him for a very wealthy man. He is not. He is homeless. His clothes are bedraggled. And he also starts a friendship with a wealthy man as well, who only acknowledges him when he is drunk. So there's a lot of hijinks that sort of flow from that. And using his connection to the wealthy man, he finds a way to help the blind girl through her poverty and also with her issue of blindness to get some miraculous surgery to find eyesight,
yeah.
Which leads to one of the, I think, one of the greatest endings in film history. So that's pretty much the synopsis of the film, but let's talk about how it was received critically, I suppose, because nowadays it's easy to look back, isn't it, Carl, with hindsight to say that this is probably one of the greatest films ever made, but at the time it was barely even acknowledged by awards bodies. Like the Oscars didn't have a peep at it.
Yeah, it's interesting about the awards, considering that, like you say, it's a film that's gone on to, it's a quite regular fixture on lists of greatest films ever made and that kind of thing. From what I've seen, the reviews were pretty positive, though. You know, the reviews were often quite glowing. And I think the film did well commercially. I think even though I think one of the interesting things is it comes out, it had been such a long production, but it comes out into quite a dire economic situation in the United States. But it earned twice back what it cost to make. But yeah, no, I think it was well reviewed. I was surprised. I was doing a bit of reading on Chaplin earlier today, and I was reading about Modern Times, which of course we're not talking about today, but I was surprised that Modern Times was a bit more coolly received by critics, and has also gone on to be seen as a classic, one of his greatest films, etc. But it seems to me like City Lights was pretty popular with the public and with the critics of the day, but as you point out, not necessarily the awards bodies, which is interesting.
I wonder if that's something that the Academy, which often, in my opinion, gets it wrong quite regularly, I wonder if they regret not acknowledging City Lights. And it seems to me like it felt probably antiquated to them as well at the time, being that it was that old style. They were moving in a new direction. Even a brilliant film like Sunrise, A Song of Two Humans, in 1927, they were lithe to recognize that properly. A bit of a tragedy, if you ask me, on that particular case. Tell me, Carl, when is the first time that you saw City Lights? Like, do you have any memories of that time?
I don't actually have that any distinct memories of that. I was trying to think about this earlier. I can sort of pinpoint a rough time when I think it probably happened. I think it probably happened in the early 2000s, maybe 2001, 2002, because I know that at that age I was getting into film fairly deeply and seeking out a lot of stuff. I was looking at like lists of greatest films ever made and going away and trying to find them. So I suspect City Lights was probably the first Chaplin film I saw. I'm not sure if it was Modern Times. It was one of those two, I believe. But I can't quite remember the exact experience. It may have been the first silent film I saw, because I think that's one of the interesting things, isn't it? That in terms of what's lived on in terms of popular memory for people these days about what the silent films involve. I think still for a lot of people, Charlie Chaplin is somebody they would picture quite readily, isn't he? And I think that was probably my experience too. I probably saw some Chaplin, some Keaton, maybe some like early Hitchcock, like The Lodger, you know, and it probably then took me a little while to get to more silent stuff. So I can't exactly remember sitting down to watch it for the first time. I think I saw it on television over here, which again is interesting because I don't know about what it's like where you are, but in the UK, it's very rare these days to see a silent film screened on TV. But yeah, I remember liking it immediately when I saw it. I think it's such a deceptively simple film, isn't it? But it's one that really builds to something, which of course we'll go on to talk about. And then I've revisited it several times over the years. But no, I don't have great memories of that first viewing. How about you?
I am so delighted to hear that silent films get shown on the rare occasion over in the UK. I wonder if that's because Charlie Chaplin, being British himself, is he kind of acknowledged as one of your great artists, really, over in the UK? Because I know that he moved his career to America, so I know America claim anything that moves when they go over there. But is he kind of like revered in that way in the UK?
I would say so, and I would say there's been an interesting shift there, perhaps, and I'm just going off what I've sort of perceived. I haven't done a proper like study of this, but when I was growing up, I just knew who Charlie Chaplin was by some kind of like weird cultural osmosis. Like, I hadn't seen a Chaplin film, but I could have drawn you like a little silhouette of Chaplin, you know what I mean? I could have drawn a little stick man version of Chaplin. I don't know if that has started to recede finally away, which, I mean, considering we're talking about films that are, you know, 80, 90, 100 years old, you could understand that. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure the next generation now has the same sort of knowledge of Chaplin. Maybe they do. Maybe I'm wrong. But I think for a long, long time, he was a real cultural fixture. It's interesting. I think whenever he came back to England at the height of his fame, I've been reading about this earlier today, he was kind of mobbed by crowds and things. So I think he was, you know, the public adored him, despite the fact he had left for America, as you rightly point out.
So to answer your other question, my first time seeing it, I do have some memories of it. It was not my first Chaplin. Very similar story to you. I started to get into movies quite a bit more seriously, I suppose. My taste became, if I can say, a bit more sophisticated. when I was about 18, 19, so that's about mid-2000s, 2006, 2007. And I sought out The Great Dictator first because I was a bit of a World War II history nerd. So while Hitler obviously was an abhorrent person, I found his motivations and things very, very curious and fascinating, you know, and I wanting to know how that person ticked was very interesting to me. And then finding out that Charles Chaplin made this anti-war spoof comedy kind of absolutely just dunking on Hitler during the war, which is just like untold kind of nuts, really, when you think about it. I had to seek it out. I was, as I said, I was starting to get into more sophisticated film at that point. So seeking out The Great Dictator was, and that still is one of my top 10 movies. Like, I think because of the shift that it had on me at that time as well, it's very influential on me. So then, of course, seeking out, you know, The Kid, The Gold Rush, City Lights, Modern Times, they were definitely next on the hit list. I think City Lights was literally the next one I saw. And it's just got this sort of magic spell, hasn't it, that you, it's hard to describe because silent films, I think, you know, they're not popular, obviously, for a lot of reasons. And this is before The Artist as well, which sort of, as a novelty, kind of reinvigorated silent films for about a month or so. But realistically, no one watches them anymore, or unless you really seek them out. So it was bizarre, it was different, it was unique, it was all those things. And they had this certain kind of magic. There was just it seemed, and I know that I'm wrong about this now that I've read about this film, it seemed effortless.
No, I fully agree. It's deceptively simple, isn't it? And then you go to read about how it was made and you realize that what comes off on the screen is just effortlessness and mastery was very difficult to achieve. Yeah, it's interesting what you're saying as well about the fact that you're right, there isn't much of a cultural appreciation these days about silent film. Do you think Chaplin's a good way in for people? Because I think he is, because just I think the appeal of the tramp is so important to that, isn't it? Because, you know, he appeals to people who don't quite fit in. He remains quite enigmatic, doesn't he? So you can project a lot onto the tramp. And I think the fact that he doesn't speak is a big part of that. He's just a very relatable figure, isn't he? Battling against a world that can often be quite uncaring and cruel and hostile. And I think that's a good way to... that archetypal character is a good way in for people to maybe start to appreciate some silent films.
I think so, because, for one, people are accustomed to franchises now. So if you have, like, if you have, like, one character that carries over between pieces of art, I think that helps. Maybe snide comments aside, I think...
we never got the Avengers film with, like, you know, Chaplin, Keaton, Harold Lloyd, you know, Well, I suppose we did get Chaplin and Keaton together in Limelight, but you know what I mean.
We did, but, you know, not their best work. Yeah. They certainly... It was kind of like getting Downey Jr. and Evans together when they're 70, you know? It's a little bit... It's not quite the same. But I would say yes, and I think it was Ebert that said it best when he spoke about, you know, he was probably the one character, the tramp, that was truly silent, whereas Buster Keaton's characters were quite talkative. They didn't really suit silent films, you know. He was obviously physically a specimen, and so was Lloyd, as you mentioned, but and Chaplin was too, but Chaplin's the tramp was genuinely silent for most of the time. It was kind of like, I don't know if you're a Kevin Smith fan at all, but like, you know, when Clerks and Mallrats and Chasing Amy and Dogma, Silent Bob is silent for most of the time. He does talk very, very occasionally. And the tramp kind of reminds me of that, you know, like when he talks, it actually carries a sense of gravitas, you know, when that title card comes up, because it's so rare that he talks. It's not part of his makeup. And also, as you mentioned, his ability to sit outside of society gives him probably an ability to comment on society, as an ally to us, from the outside. So looking at, you know, the the behavior of the millionaire in City Lights, for example, which I find kind of relatable at times because, you know, he's just had a breakup and that's really sad, and all the money in the world can't save him from feeling sad and he just wants to end it all. I can relate to that, but then at the same time, I can also not relate to the fact that he's just a completely different person when he's not drunk. I don't respect that. I think that's terrible. And from the outside looking in, Chaplin's character is able to observe that and feel the full force of it. And I think it enables the audience to connect with it a little bit more that way as well. Yeah. I think it was Ebert. I can't claim total credit for that thought. I think it was Ebert that came up with that one. That it's something that I do certainly agree with. What about you? Would you suggest that he is a good entry point?
I think so, because I think what's lovely about the tramp is he's kind of like an object of pity, isn't he? But he always retains his dignity, you know? And I think Chaplin's very good at getting us to root for that character. It's just masterfully, as a comic creation, I think the tramp is always masterfully played by Chaplin. He just, you know, we can intellectualize it a bit and say, yeah, he represents the downtrodden or whatever. But at the heart of it all is he just makes people laugh, doesn't he? And I think, you know, it's worth noting that Chaplin was phenomenally popular with kids as well as with adults, you know. I think that speaks to how elemental his comic power was. And universal, the fact that, I mean, he had a level of fame that I think it's quite difficult for us to comprehend today.
Yes.
With how fragmented, like, the media landscape is. But Chaplin was loved all over the world, more, you know, pretty much. And I think silent cinema kind of allowed that because, and I think that's what Chaplin was worried about with this film, is, like, if you give the tramp a voice, does that immediately kind of shrink his audience because, you know, maybe people from other countries can't relate to him quite so easily. So, yeah, no, I think there's something to that. And I think, absolutely, I think he's a good entry point for people who maybe don't know much about silent film, not least because a film like City Lights or some of his other films have been remarkably well preserved, haven't they? I don't know how you watched the film, but I watched the Blu-ray disc. Mm. And it's really well presented. There's a few good extras and things like that. So they've been treated well over the years, I think, Chaplin's film.
Yeah, probably better than all others, frankly, because he has that that amazing cut-through. Like, as you mentioned, he was stupidly popular to the point that he was revered as the most recognizable image or recognizable person on the entire planet. I think that's since been taken over by images like the McDonald's logo and the Apple logo and things right. like that. But yeah. But prior to that, it was some dude with a bowler hat and a cane and a weird gait, you know.
Yeah.
What became a terrible mustache, but at the time fairly much he's. Let's dive into. I guess what I'd like to talk about is the themes of the film, because I think when it comes to silent films, it's sometimes hard for people to buy into them because, you know, people aren't used to it. It's a very different speed to watch a film at, I think. Like, you're watching 90 minutes of somebody not talking, and that can be very confusing for modern audiences. But I think it's the themes of it and as well as the assuredness of the delivery that kind of makes it a bit more palatable for a modern audience. For example, I've seen a bunch of silent films now. I'm fairly well versed in it, to the point that I can watch Metropolis and be okay. That's a very long silent film. But my partner is a little bit younger than me, and it was her first time, I think, ever watching a silent film. And if it's not her silent film, it's definitely her first Chaplin. So I was a bit worried, you know. We were on holiday, and I was just like, "Oh, look, I don't want to ruin this holiday, but I really need to watch this movie." And she's like, "Okay, all right." And she liked it, you know. She didn't love it the same way that I do, I'm pretty happy with that result, you know, because it's tough to get into, but I think it's the themes of love love's transforming ability, I suppose, to that sort of gives it that resonance with a modern audience. Is that one of the themes that you picked up on, or is there a different kind of vibe that you're picking up from the film?
I suppose what I picked up on is it sets up this quite effective dichotomy, doesn't it? So you have the world of love, I guess, which is represented by the flower girl, and Chaplin's interactions with her. And I think that stuff's great because it doesn't feel tacked on in any way. Like, I suppose a comparison I would make, and it's not quite an exact comparison, but maybe like the Marx Brothers, in some of their films, like A Night at the Opera or A Day at the Races, I think you have like a love plot, which always feels kind of tacked on and a bit kind of unnecessary because what you're really there for is the comic routines.
Right.
And of course, the great thing with Chaplin is you're there for the comic routines as well. And you get some great showcases in that regard in this film. But it, like I say, it builds that crescendo at the end with him and the flower girl. But yeah, the dichotomy between that world of love and caring and then the world of wealth, which is quite differentiated from that, isn't it? So you've got money, which defines that world, and, you know, flowers as an emblem of the second. And it's pretty simple, but it again, deceptively simple. It works really well. And I believe that that division was not so clear cut in the script initially. It kind of was honed in on as they made the film. But yeah, I suppose the tramp moves between those worlds, and Chaplin does things to kind of link it, doesn't he? So, like, you know, I think the suicide attempt scene where the guy goes in the water.
Mm-hmm.
But I think at the end of that scene, Chaplin drops the flower. It's kind of a reminder about the other storyline. So, you know, like the flower girl is off screen for quite a substantial amount of time, and then the millionaire's off screen for quite some time. They don't ever really interact. But yeah, the tramp moves between those worlds. So I guess that's the main sort of thematic thing I picked up on.
I could definitely see that. And I appreciate the effect that, say, I just had a bit of a aha moment when you were talking about how he drops that flower during the millionaire scene. And I didn't even observe the functionality of it, which you rightly point out is just to be like, hey, just remember that, you know, linking all of this is the motivation to be a better man, I suppose, or a good man and be there for this girl that I've fallen in love with. Who's just thrown water all over me, when she's, I love that scene. But the functionality of it is that, yes, but for me, it was just purely like, just a purely emotional reaction to that. Like I almost had one of those really dorky kind of, aww, like, I think my partner literally did. And that's something that, thanks for pointing that out. I really admired the fact that I think it's a comment on the downtrodden and putting it into context. Like, the tramp has been a character of his for a couple of decades by this point in City Lights, but as you mentioned right from the top, it was right during that really, really tough period, particularly in the USA, but the world over as well, the Great Depression.
Yeah.
In 1931, of course, there was the crash a couple of years earlier than that. It put a pause on production for a couple of months, I believe, which is a pretty good result. And the fact that I think there were a lot of people that were relatively comfortable in their lives, maybe even wealthy, and suddenly they were the downtrodden. And there would have been a lot of people that maybe didn't have access to see that film at that time, but in that world, there would have been people watching this movie that maybe had a cousin or a father or a son or something that had just suddenly fallen upon hard times, and they would have felt invisible in a capitalist society, as they often are, really. And he was literally unseen by the only two other major characters in the film. It was literally unseen by the flower girl, of course. She couldn't see she actually could see who he truly was by not seeing the homeless side of him. And the drunken millionaire couldn't see who he truly was because once he was of clear state, he just saw a tramp and that was that. He wasn't his friend. He wasn't the person that saved his life. He was a tramp, and tramps aren't to be respected.
Yeah.
And in modern lingo, I mean, tramp is obviously maybe quite a Britishism or maybe quite an old saying, but basically a homeless person is what we see as a tramp. So the fact that I think the love transformed him from being just some invisible tramp to being, okay, well, no, she loves him. She actually truly loves him. And whether she can see or not, it doesn't matter, because what she actually saw was his heart and his spirit and his kindness and love's ability to lift us out of whatever situation we're in, I think, was something that I really, really picked up on there, which I really appreciated.
Yeah, and I think there's a scene between the girl and a grandmother, isn't it? Quite early on, where the grandmother's saying, like, is he a rich man? And, like, I think the flower girl says something like, on the title card, it says, like, yes, but that's not all he is, or something like that. Something that kind of sets up the idea quite early that, you know, it's not just about his money. And it's really interesting what you're saying about it being kind of a Depression-era film in some ways, because I think that points to the fact that there's something quite serendipitous about that in a weird sort of way, because from what I can gather, the key ideas of this film were developed, and again, it had such a long production, those sort of key ideas about the millionaire and things were developed well before the stock market crash.
Yes.
But then they acquire a new timeliness given the context the film is released into. I think something like Modern Times from Chaplin, which is obviously a few years down the line, but I think that's much more of an overtly political film where he's kind of critiquing the system and this and that. I think with this one, it's interesting to ponder the sort of autobiographical themes that might be percolating here. Because, I mean, you've got, that's always evident in The Tramp, I think, because you've got that connection between The Tramp and Chaplin in terms of Chaplin himself came from quite a marginalized status, the connection to poverty, obviously, and resilience. What I've read, I've read that there's a BFI book about City Lights. I had a look at it the other day. And the author there was saying that, so there's this idea that obviously you've got the tramp devoting himself to a woman who is impaired, and he goes on to successfully finance her cure. And you can read that almost as a kind of wish fulfillment for Chaplin himself, who had been devoted to his mother, who had you know, pretty severe mental health problems, and who had died in 1928. So during the period, I think, where he started to work on City Lights.
Right.
And of course, I think Chaplin's second wife, that marriage had broken down as well in the same sort of period before he made the film. So the fact that you've got the millionaires exhibiting this erratic behavior after apparently his partner has left him, you can sort of read that as, like, I think it's been called a submerged autobiographical kind of resonance. Maybe Chaplin's putting bits of himself into all of these characters, you know. And I think he'd also had some tax problems that had cost him, like, millions of pounds too. So, or millions of dollars, rather. So maybe these experiences kind of helped to sharpen his, you know, his view on things in the run-up to making this film too, which is kind of interesting to ponder.
That is interesting to ponder. I had heard some whisperings of the mother was somebody that was, you know, had some struggles mentally. But I didn't know the exact story of the second wife. So that's a fascinating little bit of personal storytelling, which is something that I'm always a fan of. I love it when an auteur gets down in the mud and starts telling not just a universal story, but finding the real story in there as well.
Kind of exposing their soul for the entertainment of others. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, and I mean, like, it seems almost kind of selfish of us to accept that, but I love the generosity of filmmakers when they do that sort of thing. I guess we could probably touch on the fact that it was a painstaking production. One thing I read is that the shoot itself took about 180 days, which is, you know, a significant length. But he had the entire cast and crew on, like, standby for something like almost 2 years, just in case he wanted to do reshoots or you know, anything really, or add anything to the movie or whatever it took. And I also read that the very, very small scene, but super important scene right at the end, where, you know, the blind girl has her sight and she recognizes the tramp when she touches his hand, that apparently had like 340 different takes or something. Like, that is like Kubrickian levels of attention to detail and almost like genuine obsessiveness to get the exact result that he wanted. As he said earlier, it was deceptively simple. That to me, I thought that scene was maybe not a one-er, but like certainly a bit easier than perhaps it was, but he was absolutely resolute in making sure that he got exactly what he wanted out of that.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard some stories about the production, and I think 673 days was the schedule is the figure I've come across. So
right,
just, you know, obviously much, much longer than a typical Hollywood shooting schedule. Apparently not that unusual for Chaplin. Apparently the circus had a very long production too. Maybe not quite to that extent, but similar issues. What I had heard was just that it was very painstaking, with some real exceptions. So I think the scene I've read the most about is that initial meeting between the tramp and the flower girl.
Right.
Which is deceptively, you know, you look at it and you think that's quite a simple scene. There's, you know, certain things are going on. And I suppose what he has to do with that scene, he has to set up the idea that, you know, the tramp has got to fall for her. She has got to come to believe he's rich, which is accomplished when the door slams of the limousine and she hears that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it moves from kind of pathos to comedy when she throws the water over him. So there are a few things going on. But then when you read that they worked on it for over a month, first of all, and then they returned to it 5 times for reshoots, you just, the mind kind of boggles. But it doesn't matter because the final effect is so kind of accomplished. It doesn't feel like something that's been laboriously poured over to that point where it kind of stifles the creativity or anything. What I heard was that there are other sequences which were a bit more easy to achieve, like the boxing match and like the thing at the boxing match in the locker room, that sequence where he's rubbing the rabbit's foot over him and all that. I don't think he kind of sweated over those to the same extent. So that's good to know. There were, yeah, weird things going on where I think you had actors fired. So the first actor to play the millionaire was fired.
Yeah, I heard that.
And then, Virginia Cheryl, who plays the flower girl, was fired temporarily. Apparently it was after she was rehired that the production began to go a bit more smoothly. So, I don't know, he made films in an atypical way, Chaplin, because what I hear here is that, like, you know, pre-production kind of bled into production because you like to change a story and refine it while he was shooting. So very unlike, I suppose the classic example is Hitchcock, isn't it? Where you hear all sorts of things about Hitchcock where it's like shooting the film was the most boring part for him because he'd done it all in his head and it was all mapped out.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't like, you hear that he didn't like, you know, actors are just like cattle is the famous quote from him.
Yeah.
And Chaplin sounds like kind of the opposite where he's being very hands-on with the actors and he's working things out as he goes along. Very different ways to achieve the result of a great film, I suppose.
Well, and to that point, I mean, you have the Hitchcocks of the world, some of my favorite films made with that surgeon's precision that he has. But on the same token, I also love Wong Kar-wai, you know, and his approach is very much like, I don't work with scripts. What are scripts? Like, let's just go out there and have a basic idea of what we're going to do. And it's amazing to me that a movie like In the Mood for Love in 2000 was basically unscripted. To me, it's just like, what, that movie has a beautiful script. What are we, like, what are you talking about? I would love to read that screenplay. And I was shocked to hear that I frankly couldn't. Yeah, I appreciate that he sort of blended the two, I suppose. He has that, as I mentioned, that Stanley Kubrick attention to detail and that obsessiveness with getting exactly the right shot. And look, out of the 300 and whatever it takes it was of that final scene, how many of them, probably to our eyes, completely nailed it? I don't know, maybe 200 of them, for all we know. But for him, it was probably just that one. Or maybe two or three, but he definitely wanted to have some safety and he wanted to make sure that he had, I don't know, some options when it came to cutting the film, like literally cutting the film. And I respect that. I respect that a great deal. I loved the story that you briefly touched on there with Virginia Cheryl, who played the blind flower girl, who, she quit because they didn't like each other very much. They were basically like acquaintances before she got the gig, of the role. And she did quit. And then, on the advice of another famous actress, her name escapes my mind right now, she basically demanded that she got double the pay as she returned because she realized how integral she was to the success of the film. So Chaplin would have had to eat his humble pie at that point, and which doesn't seem like something that he would have liked to do. He seemed like quite a domineering character, and maybe a bit difficult to work with, which again, it seems kind of odd because the Tramp is this happy-go-lucky, lovable character, and I think that carries over into our impression of Charles Chaplin. But he may well have been a horrible person to work with, for all we know, like, if her testimony is anything to go by.
Yeah, it's one of those things, isn't it, where I think the Tramp is quite like Charlie Chaplin in some respects, and then there are probably other ways, like their attitude to work, where they can be quite unlike each other, yeah. What I'd heard about Cheryl is that, because I think the story is that he had discovered her, you know, quote-unquote, that's the famous phrase, isn't it? But he had discovered her at a boxing match, apparently. And when she was offered the job, she was like, well, I've got no experience of acting. And he said, that's what I want, otherwise you would have to unlearn what you know. As I do things differently, I will show you what to do. So I think when you said domineering, I think that's probably the right word for it, isn't it? Because the sense you pick up about Chaplin when you read about how he worked was he knew what he wanted. He didn't always know. Well, he knew it when he saw it, and he would be insistent on getting that effect no matter what it took, you know. So I can't imagine that was a very pleasant situation to work in for a lot of people. And I think even like 50 years later, she was giving interviews where she was saying, like, you know, I didn't like him and he didn't much like me and that kind of thing. So it's a shame, but I think it all melts away when you see the stuff on screen, doesn't it?
Let's talk about the influence of City Lights, because on one hand, you'd say it is probably one of the greatest films ever made. I think the consensus just dictates that, whatever our actual take on that is. But I don't think, in a lot of ways, it may not have been super influential because of the pantomime style kind of dying out. And it's sort of, by this point in history, being very much his own thing. What's your take on this? Because usually when this question comes up in this podcast, it's like, yeah, super influential. Like, wow, can you imagine? But in this particular film, I'm not entirely sure that there was a great deal of influence.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. That was my reaction earlier when I was trying to think about this. Is like, in some ways, you can't say that it is that influential because that era of silent film had effectively passed already. It's difficult to make that case, I think. I was looking at the IMDb page. I was just thinking, like, well, what films have referenced City Lights? And there are 40 or 50 films where it says there's a reference to City Lights in this film. Some of them seem quite tenuous, though.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's had a long afterlife, but I think it's different to it having this like real big influence on later stuff. So, for instance, I think it was re-released in 1950, and Life magazine named it the best film of the year, which is kind of a funny thing, because they weren't that impressed with the new films that were released at that time, for whatever reason.
Right.
And then the barometer I always tend to look at, I don't know if you pay much attention to it, but the British film magazine Sight and Sound does the 10-yearly mm-hmm. greatest films of all time poll. And that's kind of, obviously, there's always the issue with polls, like, well, they exclude more than they include, and who makes the, you know, who decides, who's the arbiter, and all of that. But it just gives you a nice impression. And, like, in 1952, which was the first time they did that list, City Lights was the second greatest film of all time,
mm-hmm.
according to them. I think it was equal 14th in 1962. I couldn't see it. I'd only saw the top 10s for the next few decades. But then in 2012, it was like 50th on the critics poll and was higher than that on the director's poll. So yeah, just the idea of it, it's commonly regarded as a great film. Like there was a BBC poll of film critics a few years ago about the greatest ever American film. City Lights placed at number 18. So yeah, for its quality, it definitely is a significant film, isn't it? I think in terms of, if you're looking at where is the influence of City Lights on what came later, it's harder to see because that silent film era had faded, hadn't it? That's my initial feeling. Does that sound about right?
I think so. But one thing that you touched on there, which I realize it probably did have some obviously profound influence on some pretty important people. You mentioned that directors love it. Now, I had a cursory look through the IMDb trivia page, as well as some other things that I found. And the amount of very prominent directors that either say this is Chaplin's best, their favorite Chaplin, or just their favorite movie ever. Like even coming down to recently, like Guillermo del Toro saying that it was his favorite. And I look at a movie like Pan's Labyrinth or The Shape of Water, and I sit there and go, wow, like there's a whimsy at times to his filmmaking, right? Like I'm not sure if you saw The Shape of Water, but there's this one point where the woman that can't speak, the main character, she just starts singing and dancing, like right in the middle of this movie, in this weird kind of cutaway moment that's in her fantasy or something. And to me, it was just like, whoa, like that level of whimsy is something that I could see Charlie Chaplin accomplishing. You know, that freedom just to be a bit silly, be a bit out there and be really expressive is something that Chaplin probably had an influence on in those early days. I mean, in terms of influential filmmakers in that era, you're looking at the likes of, obviously, Chaplin and Keaton. You're looking at D.W. Griffith. You're looking at F.W. Murnau. And there's probably a couple of others that are escaping my mind right this moment. But the influence that he had compared to those other guys was maybe that whimsy, maybe that freedom, that expression, that... And for so many directors to say, yeah, this is the guy, this is the movie, while stylistically, directly stylistically, it may not have been influential, I think it does cast a long shadow, doesn't it, I suppose?
Yeah, I suppose, I think in terms of him being a very popular figure for directors, I think you'd have to say Chaplin is like a classic auteur, as it were, because he had a highly unusual degree of creative control, didn't he? Like, if you just look at this film, he wrote it, he directed it, he's the star, the producer, the composer. So it's very much, you know, the auteur sort of approach, the auteur theory has its limitations. But someone like Chaplin is somebody you can make a case for. And this, I believe, is his fourth film for United Artists, mm-hmm. which he'd formed in conjunction with Douglas Fairbanks, Mary Pickford, and D.W. Griffith. And that run, I think, began 1923 with A Woman of Paris. So with that film and The Gold Rush and The Circus, they kind of laid the groundwork for City Lights, because that broad emotional appeal that this film has had kind of developed. Just the formulaic elements, like there's going to be a tramp's going to be there, there's going to be a romance between a tramp and a woman, etc., etc. In terms of it casting a long shadow, and in terms of Chaplin as an auteur, I suppose, now that you mention it, I think the figure that probably comes to mind for me, who's in a lot of ways quite Chaplin-esque, is Woody Allen, you know, in terms of the fact that he has this this persona that he reproduces, you know, the sort of schlemiel figure that Allen tends mm-hmm. to play. The blending of like humor and pathos is very common in his films, which I think Chaplin was an expert at. Chaplin's been compared to like Charles Dickens, even Shakespeare, in terms of how good he was at doing mm-hmm. that, you know, and I think Allen is similar. So yeah, whether you could say City Lights, I suppose City Lights is often held up as his best film, Chaplin, or certainly in the running for it. So it does cast a long shadow, I think.
I love that comparison with Woody Allen, and I think Woody Allen's, some of my favorite Woody Allen movies, like I think people naturally go to Annie Hall or they go to Manhattan, maybe. For me, I love The Purple Rose of Cairo. I love even Midnight in Paris, one of his more recent ones. And part of that is because of that playfulness, that whimsy, that loss into fantasy, that I could see if Chaplin was a modern filmmaker, he may well have made movies very similar to those, I think. Maybe even more so than Manhattan.
Or even Hannah and Her Sisters, I think, would be a great example, where you have Alan's character is kind of the comic relief, and you have more serious stuff, like with Michael Caine and some of the other characters.
Yes.
And it builds to a very powerful sort of scene of emotionality in that. So, yeah, no, I think there is something to that. I believe Alan is a fan of Chaplin too, from what I remember.
Yeah,
he felt that Keaton was a better filmmaker, but Chaplin was funnier, I think, is what I think.
And he did say that City Lights was Chaplin's best. So to tie that one in very nicely, yes.
There we go.
Sort of a take without notice, I suppose. I've thought about this before. And so I've got maybe an unfair advantage on you here, but I think that Chaplin is the most influential person in film history. Now, the reason I say that, and you sort of rattled off a bunch of reasons before, when he made a movie, he was You know, he was the star, he was the director, he probably wrote all the material, he literally composed a bunch of the music once they sort of veered into that sound era. He was the money as well. He literally, as you say, helped co-found United Artists, which was a big player at the time. And in terms of being film's first genuine star and the person that, you know, without that first genuine star, film might not survive. People might not be going to the movies as often, and therefore it's not a tenable venture to make movies. And then maybe you don't get, you know, Joan of Arc or, you know, Sunrise or Nosferatu or yeah. The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari or whoever. That's my take. I think he is the most influential person in all of cinema history, to the success of cinema. Do you reckon I'm crazy?
Hot take. I don't think you're crazy. No, I think that's interesting. I would have to ponder that, but I think the case is a strong one because he's such a foundational figure, isn't he? In terms of such an early film star, that I think that you may be onto something. I suppose if you'd have asked me that question without attaching Chaplin's name to it, like who is the most influential figure in film history, who would I have said? Would I have immediately gone to Chaplin? I feel like I might have more readily gone to Alfred Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm.
But I, now that you mention it, I think you may well be onto something. I suppose with Hitchcock, I'm looking at the fact that with films like, I mean, you point to a lot of things, but so much of like modern horror, for instance, you can sort of trace back to the DNA of Psycho and The Birds.
Mm-hmm.
And just the idea of, I think the idea of what a film director is and what a film director does, I think a lot of that goes back to Hitchcock in certain ways. But you could say the same about Chaplin, couldn't you, I suppose?
Well, and Hitchcock was very foundational as well. Like you say, he was making silent films during his time in Britain. So, you know, like, yes, he's absolutely it. I think timing is everything when it comes to these sort of things and these sort of debates. You could make the argument that Spielberg is one of the most influential people in film ever, but Spielberg built off of the foundations that were laid by others, and that's not his fault. And he is very influential, absolutely. I think he's definitely top 10. But Hitchcock sort of laid a lot of foundations for horror, for thrillers, and for the way that drama stories are told. Chaplin laid a lot of foundations for film generally. D.W. Griffith as well, obviously.
Yeah.
That's my hot take of the day, I suppose, on movieversaries, on the 90th anniversary of City Lights. I think Charlie Chaplin is the most influential person in film history.
I think he would definitely be in the running, wouldn't he? If this was a boxing match between, you know, all the pretenders for the crown of the most influential people in film history, Charlie Chaplin would be in there, like, spinning his arms around like he does in City Lights.
hiding behind the referee.
I think that's a very good scene, isn't it? Because that shows you how, because it's not played at all like a serious boxing match, but there's a very serious emotional core to it.
Yeah.
So that when he gets knocked out, and you're primed for it to be the happy ending coming from that scene, aren't you? You're kind of primed, because you're kind of like an hour into the film by that point. You're sort of braced for that to be, he's going to somehow pull off a miraculous upset, he's going to win the money, and then that's going to take us to the ending of the film. But that doesn't happen. And when it doesn't happen, I think it packs quite a punch, even though it's very broad comedy, you know. When he's going into the ring and he's letting the sort of the other guys go into the ring, but, you know, he's not at all the kind of macho boxer that you kind of expect to see.
I totally agree. And I think that sort of actually jumps us into the next point, which is, I'm the kind of person that takes words very literally, by the way. You'll know this about me when you get to know me a bit better. But the word great gets thrown around a lot. I think some people just sit there and say, oh, yeah, we had a great night last night. You know, we had a few drinks. It's like, cool. Okay. Like, that's above average. Okay. Like, you've used great that way. That's fine. You're allowed to do that. That's okay. But I don't like it when someone tells me that, what's a run-of-the-mill movie? I don't know. The Green Book from a couple of years ago. Someone told me that was a great movie. And I'm like, okay. You're entitled to your opinion. That's awesome. But you're probably saying it's above average. You're probably saying that you liked it and that you had a good time watching it. But it's not a great film. It's not in that pantheon of great films. When I throw that around, do you agree that City Lights is a great film?
I think it is. And I think you hit an interesting topic there, because I think sometimes it's kind of the instant rush to acclaim something as great can be the issue, can't it? And I think you guys were talking about this on the Spirit of the Way discussion, the whole idea of, like, was it an instant classic? Mm-hmm. And I think you always have to be a bit wary about, saying that something is great instantly or that it's a classic. I think that's why Movieversaries is a great idea for a podcast, because at least you can approach all of these films with a healthy amount of perspective. Obviously, we've got a lot of perspective on City Lights at this point. I think it's a great film. I think it was Howard Hawks who once put forward the maxim, which was like, to make a good movie, you need 3 great scenes and no bad ones. So I think immediately, I think City Lights is a good movie on those terms, because I think there are several very memorable great sequences here. Mm-hmm. There's no scene here for me, I don't know what your thoughts are, but there's nothing here that pops up on screen and I'm like, oh my God, I can't wait till this scene is over. You know, there are no real false notes that I perceived. Mm-hmm. I think some people have said that the film is too episodic, but I don't really feel that, because I enjoy seeing Chaplin get a showcase. I think what makes it a great film is that final scene for me. It is, like I said earlier, it's really a film that builds to a crescendo. It's very powerful, and I think it's interesting that Chaplin rarely uses close-ups normally, you know, but you can tell he knew how effective they could be when they're used at the right time. And that final scene is wonderful, because it's like, how exactly do we take it? Like, do we take it optimistically? Mm. Or is there a more pessimistic way to take it? Because it's interesting how when it goes to black, the musical score carries on for quite a long time. And I think there are some darker sort of tones that come in. I believe I read that there were some minor chords that come in with the final notes of the score. So it's like, when you fast forward from the end of the narrative, what exactly happens with these two people? And I think the final scene captures the power of that so beautifully. Like, Chaplin's face is that weird mixture of, he's delighted. There seems to me to be a hint of, like, terror in his expression too. And whatever's going on there, it all culminates in a very powerful emotional effect, I think, which means that as funny as the other stuff is, it really packs a punch for me. And I think that is what makes it a great film.
Yeah. I like, as you mentioned with the boxing scene, you know, the idea that, yeah, it's funny and it's so well executed. And, you know, if there was a slight criticism of it, maybe takes like a minute too long, you know, just maybe, or maybe they fall in the water a couple of times too many during that attempted suicide of the millionaire.
It's more than one.
Yeah, and it's like maybe he just drags the joke on a couple of scenes, maybe. But, you know, I mean, that's a small gripe, isn't it? No, there is greatness here, and some of those scenes, the boxing scene is a great example of amazing slapstick pantomime comedy, but having that serious layer that you're talking about as well, you know, drawing it back to that emotional core and that emotional punch that it has. And it builds up towards that emotional punch right by the end, which is one of the great emotional punches. I still think, as I said from the top, I think it is one of the dead set, one of the best endings. If you and me were going to make a list of top 10 endings we've seen, it might fall on there, it might not, but if one of us did put it there, I think it would be fairly justified. You'd be hard-pressed arguing against it, don't you think?
Yeah, I think if you're talking to me about indelible film endings, City Lights would be one that comes to mind. Something like the 400 blows, the final freeze frame moment there comes to mind.
Yeah.
There will be others too, obviously. I think I saw a quote from Chaplin in the 1967 interview where he talked about it, because I think he had said that City Lights was his favourite of his own films on multiple occasions. And in terms of that last scene, he said, the key was exactly right, slightly embarrassed, delighted about meeting her again, apologetic without getting emotional about it. He was watching and wondering what she was thinking and wondering without any effort. It's one of the purest inserts, I call them inserts, close-ups, that I've ever done. One of the purest. So I like the description of pure in conjunction with that scene. Mm. In terms of what you're saying about some of the scenes being a bit longer, that's interesting. I wonder how you feel about this, but when I've seen silent films at home, I tend to have a different reaction to the few occasions I've been able to see one on the big screen. So I've seen Chaplin's The Circus on the big screen, and I'd already seen the film on DVD, I think, and liked it. Mm. But then seeing it with an audience was a much different thing. There was much more laughter, and things kind of are funnier than what, just that communal setting makes things funnier than they would otherwise appear to me. I've seen The General that way too, the Keaton's film, The General, and had the a similar experience where I really admired the film at home and then found it kind of uproarious kind of at the cinema. I wonder if some of those scenes you're talking about, like the boxing match, the scene by the water, I wonder if they would play differently in a crowd, whether they would, whether the laughter, you know, I think it would produce more laughter, basically.
I think, well, both of us sound like we haven't seen City Lights, and I think you're right that, in a cinema at least, I think you're right that comedy and maybe horror are the two that really play differently, don't they? Like, I recently saw, and I reviewed it for Real Talk, our other official movie podcast, A Quiet Place 2, which, you know, it's fine. It's fine, right? But when you see it, when you see it in a cinema, you know, all those kind of corny setups or whatever it is, they play a bit different because everyone's gasping or super quiet. And if someone just like ruffles the popcorn a little bit, people start like, you know, looking around and I don't know. It does play a bit different. I would love to see City Lights. I'd love to see The Great Dictator, Modern Times, The Kid, in a cinema. Yeah. I would love that. Shout out to Brisbane cinemas in Australia. Like, if we can make that happen for me, and obviously in the UK for Carl as well, that'd be great.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Do you think, as I said, I think as a modern viewer, and with our very attuned sense of what is comedic and what is comedic timing nowadays, I found a couple of those scenes just a little bit off-putting, like I mentioned. But in terms of shortcomings for this film, that's pretty much all I can really find. That's an incredible piece of nitpicking. Do you have any shortcomings? Anything that sort of halts the momentum, I suppose, for you, or anything like that?
Not massively. I think when I was looking at what some of the reviewers had said, I think one or two of them had said, well, maybe it's a bit too episodic. I think it's fine because I like everything we see. There is a deleted scene on the DVD. I don't know if you've seen it. It's about 7 minutes long. It involves like a piece of wood that's got stuck in the floor outside in the street.
Right.
And Chaplin's trying to dislodge it. And it goes on and on, like a crowd gathers, and then, you know, a woman comes along, and it kind of builds on that. And I think he was wise to delete that from the film, because I think it really has no connection to what's going on around it. And I think it is too protracted at 7 minutes long. So I think if that had been in there, I probably would have pointed to that as a shortcoming. It's kind of interesting in, you know, it's got some historical value as, you know, seeing the outtakes on the DVD is quite interesting now. But no, in terms of what's in the film, I don't have any real qualms. I think it's all pretty delightful, to be honest. Maybe I'm not discerning enough. That could be true. That could be the issue.
I think that's harsh on yourself. Again, you'd find it hard pressed finding a shortcoming. One thing that we should never do as critics is judge a movie by its outtakes. Like, you know, they're left on the floor very deliberately. But what you can do is you can appreciate the restraint, I suppose. To
kill your darlings is what they call it.
Yeah. Like, I mean, he would have put a lot of effort into that scene. Being 7 minutes long, there would have been a lot of takes, a lot of extras involved, whatever it is. And, you know, he would have written it. He would have set up the cameras. The cameras were not easy to set up back then. And, you know, just to leave that on the cutting room floor, quite literally, because they're literally cutting film at that time, is commendable, I think. And speaks to his understanding of, okay, the pacing is going to be a little bit thrown off here if I throw in 7 minutes of funny nothing. So, yeah, I'm glad that he did that, for sure. Speaking of scenes, as you mentioned, they are really a collection of linked gags a lot of the time. Like, or scenes that are, like, yes, they might be a bit episodic, but there is a through line that keeps it healthy and strong, narratively, I think. But it is very easy to point to particular scenes in this movie. Like, in say, a modern film, there are definitely scenes, sure, but like I think there's a less obvious divide than in City Lights, where it's just like, okay, this is the boxing scene. This is the scene where he replaces the cheese on the co-worker's sandwich with soap. Yeah. This is the scene where I cry every time. What is your favorite scene?
I mean, we've already talked about the final scene. That would be my favorite. Mm. I think because we've already talked about it, let me just point to a few other moments. I think the film opens very strongly. I mean, there's the stuff with the statue, which is quite funny. It's interesting that he uses the sound effect there, doesn't it? When the dignitaries are talking, he's kind of lampooning those figures.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of high-pitched sound effect. You can sort of see that as Chaplin's rejection of film dialogue, like, from the get-go. But also that early scene where he's looking at the nude statue in the window, you know, and he's kind of walking close to that hole in the ground behind him. I just love little stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy it every time I see this film. And it's like, well, the story hasn't kicked in yet, but it's definitely like a performative highlight for Chaplin. It deepens our affinity with the tramp. And it's just very funny when the very tall man appears from the ground and Chaplin makes his retreat. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, there are others. I like the moment where he swallows the whistle, you know, and then he kind of leaves the party and then the dog comes after him and then he comes back into the party and he's got like 7 or 8 dogs. I don't know. What are some of your highlights then?
I'm glad you mentioned that one. That's in terms of pure gags, I think that one's my favorite. Like the whistle is funny and interrupting the guy while he's trying to talk. That's funny. But going outside and having the hiccups while he whistles and just having one or two dogs arrive, and that's funny enough. And then he returns to the party and there's like several. I'm just, man, that's crack up. That is such good comedy. His strength is obviously his physicality in a lot of ways. I mean, like, he has so many strengths, as we talked about. He composes the music and all that sort of stuff. But in terms of a performer, I think he's one of the strengths that is probably underrated a little bit, because it's not easy to walk the way that the tramp does and be able to have the grace that he has. It's kind of like having the grace of like a drunken penguin or something, like just able to like flawlessly just execute these. It's like a ballet dancer. That's just, you know, just a bit different, I suppose. And like that scene with the floor, absolutely agree. The statue, the fact that he's trying to stand for the he's so, honestly, what a way to open a movie. And
well, what about the nightclub stuff? That's very funny too. There's lots of stuff going on there, but like, you know, when they enter and he's like sliding on the floor and all that, and then there's all the pantomime with the cigar lighting. And again, like, there's nothing there that's, like, relevant to the story at all. But it's very funny and it's done well. Eating the spaghetti. Well, it's, like, the streamers that he thinks is the spaghetti, that kind of thing. And
breaking up the fight. That is...
Breaking up the fight. All the stuff with the chairs. You know, the woman sitting on the cigar. It's just very good stuff, though.
Absolutely classic. It reminds me, actually, I can't remember the name of it for the life of me, but it is one of his short films that he made about 1914-15, and it's basically set in a restaurant, and he does a bunch of stuff with, you know, in like hospitality gigs, if you're going in and out of the kitchen, you might have an entry door and an exit door, and you can't go in the exit door because you're going to crash into somebody or something. There's like a whole bunch of stuff that he does with that, and he's just brilliant. Like, he'll take like such a simple conceit and just maximize it to its full potential, like the eating the streamer instead of the noodle, or the swapping of chairs, or whatever it is. Like, he's honestly so brilliant. It would be, as you say, the clear winner for favorite scene is definitely the ending, but just it's so rich, like, to the point that you're sitting there saying, and what about the restaurant scene? And I think you maybe saw it on my face that I was struggling to remember it because there's so many great scenes. And then when I did remember it, I was like, oh yeah, that scene that has like 4 excellent gags. It's amazing how deep it is, really, in terms of expressionness.
Even like we mentioned the boxing, but like the locker room scene, you know, where he's like, he's just a comical sight. He's like recoiling from the other guy, like shadow boxing. His gloves look enormous on him, you know. And then, like, the boxer who he's going to split the cash with is, like, called out of town because the cops are after him. And then the other guy comes in, and there's all that stuff with, I think the other boxer giving him, like, you know, the rabbit's foot, and then comes back with a black eye, and, you know, it's very funny. Then the guy's carried back out unconscious, and, you know, just it all builds. It's genius, you know.
Yeah, it's just, and, like, trying to rub off the rabbit's foot. Like, yeah. it's so brilliant. On this podcast, we like to talk about MVPs, the most valuable player, most valuable person. It can be anyone. It could be the director, the main star, the producer, the composer. It could be any of those, the same person in this film. So obviously, it's very obvious to me that the MVP of City Lights is the second dog that comes at the whistle.
I was more of a fan of the first dog.
Yeah.
So we'll have to disagree on that. We'll have to put our boxing gloves on. No, I think it's particularly tough in this one, isn't it, to look beyond Chaplin because of the fact that he is all of those things you just said. And I think it's a crucial film for him because of the fact that it comes at this interesting point industrially, because it comes at a time that was, you know, after a time that had been quite fraught for him personally as well. As we said, the country, America, is in a transitional time. It's at this point of, like, a downward economic spiral. So it's just a fascinating film for those reasons, isn't it? It comes at a very interesting point in the life and career of Charlie Chaplin. So I think he's going to have to be my MVP. I mean, I love Virginia Cheryl in this role. I think she's really good. So I wouldn't, like, downplay the importance of some of these other figures who are significant to it, but I think it has to be Chaplin, doesn't it?
Yeah, Virginia Cheryl gets this Silver Medal for me. I would go with Chaplin with gold, absolutely. It's his movie. Ask anyone, and it's his movie. He very rarely gives up the best scenes or any show-stealing scenes to anybody else. You might make the argument that he gave it up to Keaton in Limelight, but it's rare. I wonder if we can sort of break it down just a step further, because he does put on so many hats, not just the bowler hat, for this film. What do you think he is most excelling at in this film? Like, so if he is the star, as we both agree, is his most valuable contribution as the star or the director or maybe the writing? What do you think?
I think that's hard to say, because all of those things are kind of, to some extent, working in conjunction, aren't they? I think I've seen the case made, I think it was the critic James Agee had said that he thinks Chaplin at the end of City Lights is like the height of screen acting. So I don't know if I would say necessarily agree with that, but I think he is phenomenally good as an on-screen performer in this film. I think he'd refined all of those things. You know, he was very accomplished already. He's made masterpieces already. But I think this is someone, as an on-screen performer, who's at the height of his powers. I think with scenes like that ending, he's at the height of his powers as a director. So I think I would say as a writer and as an actor and director, sorry, I think that would be what I'd be tempted to say. What about you?
It's hard to look past director, isn't it? Like, we are so in film particularly, it's you know, the director is the author, kind of, in a lot of ways, right? Like, if you're talking about who is the most valuable player in a novel, it's obviously the author. In film, it's the director gets a big head start, I think. It's impossible to make this movie without Chaplin the actor. You might be able to get a different director in and have a similar result, but I doubt it. So I'm going to give it to Chaplin, the director, absolutely. And as you say, the bleed over between pre-production and production means that the writer-director was intrintrically linked. So I would agree with you 100%. Do you think it still holds up? To a modern audience, do you think it still holds up? Maybe not just the you and maybe not this, the you and me of the world who actively try and seek out this kind of movie.
Yeah.
You know, like just a regular film goer. Do you think they're going to find some value in this?
I suppose the sad thing is most regular film goers won't end up watching City Lights, will they? To be completely honest. Hopefully some people will off the back of this podcast. You never know. I think it does hold up. I think what you said about your partner liking the film well enough is a good sign, you know. I think it's so interesting because, like, the cultural context now is very different. The cinematic and, like, aesthetic context with films today is very different. It's changed. Chaplin is still well known for a silent film star, isn't he? But he's not the phenomenon like he once was and was for a long time, was for decades. I think this is still a delightful film. I think it's still a pleasure to watch. I think it's, like I said, you can see it in very good condition, which you can't with a lot of silent films. Obviously, a lot of silent films don't even exist anymore. I think the thing with silent films is maybe you need to acquire a taste for them, is what I find with younger people. And maybe it requires a bit of effort on the part of the viewer. Maybe they need to see a few films. And I don't know if that happens so regularly these days. So I think it holds up as well as it ever did. I just think the potential kind of audience for it now is going to be very limited, which is a shame.
I agree. I can't really add much to that. I suppose taste acquiring is one of those things. And as far as taste acquiring movies go for silent films, I wouldn't be sending people down the Nosferatu road. I wouldn't be sending them down, say, like Vampire, that really, really long vampire movie. I'd be sending them to a movie like City Lights, I think, that is very playful, very lighthearted, episodic, like you say. You probably could pause it and come back to it if you needed to, if it was starting to wear you down or something like that. I think this would be a good starting point. I think it holds up in terms of themes and things like that. So in terms of relatability to a character, I think there are some ins there. So I think it does hold up, but the audience, like you mentioned, doesn't stay with it, unfortunately, which is a shame. Of the Chaplins you've seen, you said that you've seen a fair amount. Where does it sit?
This is a good question. I think it sits at or extremely close to the top. I think it's been a little while since I've rewatched Modern Times. I think that's the other one that would be in the running for me. I also really like The Circus. Like I mentioned earlier, I've seen The Circus on the big screen. I think as a pure comedy, I think that works really well. Mm. The Great Dictator, like you mentioned, is probably the next tier down for me. And I just prefer City Lights, Modern Times. I think some of this, like the climactic speech in The Great Dictator, I've never liked that much and things like that. The Gold Rush is very good. So I think it's at the top. At the moment, it's at the top because I've spent the last few days thinking about it. I've watched it recently. That all kind of pushes me. I'm on the podcast talking about it. That's encouraging me to select it as my favorite Chaplin. Realistically, I think it's between that one and Modern Times. They're pretty neck and neck. What do you think?
For me, it's definitely The Great Dictator because it was my first. And I do have that connective tissue with that modern history angle of it. And knowing how that went, you mentioned the speech not being quite, I assume you're talking about the very final speech that sort of like just mm-hmm. breaks character, breaks down the fourth wall and just speaks directly to the world. It's very hokey. It's extremely on the nose, and doesn't really fit with the movie necessarily, but it's also one of the most important speeches in film history, I think, in terms of the overall world context and what he was trying to do with the film. So, you know, you can take points away for it and you can also add points for it. It's one of those weird contradictions. Yeah. For me, yes, no, it's definitely my favorite, but that aside, it does get a head start being my first. I think City Lights is creeping up to it. Like, initially, City Lights was my second favorite, clearly my second favorite Chaplin, and also my second favorite silent film. Maybe third. But I'm starting to realize it's the one that I watch more. I watch it more than The Great Dictator. It's starting to really, really creep up now. It was 4.5 stars for me. Now it's definitely 5 stars, no question.
Oh, excellent.
It is absolutely I could recognize it as his best, but not my favorite, if you know what I mean. I think that's where I sit.
Yeah, and they are different things, aren't they, often? And I think, yeah, it's a worthwhile distinction to make, and I can see where you're coming from.
Yeah, it's kind of like with Tarantino. I think his best movie is Inglourious Basterds, but I my favorite is Pulp Fiction. It was my first, right? It's just something.
Yeah.
There's something to it. Well, Carl, I think we've basically reached the conclusion of talking about City Lights. Is there anything that you wanted to add before we plug selfish and plug our own pods?
I don't think there is. I think we've gone through the main points I wanted to bring up. I think just if anyone hasn't seen it, please rectify that. I'm surprised you made it through the podcast this far, if that is the case, but maybe you just like the sound of me and Bo talking, which is fair enough. No, I think it's a really notable film. I think it's very good. I think it's very entertaining. I think, you know, I said at the outset, I probably sought out City Lights when I was looking at films, lists of greatest films and that kind of thing. And sometimes, you know, especially when you're like younger, some of that can be a bit like, you know, doing your homework, you know, or making sure you eat your vegetables with classic films. And like, you see them, but this was different. This was one that's fun to watch. It's genuinely moving, as well as being like a very, like, significant landmark film. So yeah, I definitely encourage it to anyone who hasn't seen it.
Sometimes eating your veggies is like Brussels sprouts, and sometimes eating your veggies is like beautiful roasted pumpkin or something. And to me, this is absolutely roasted pumpkin. Which is a good thing, by the way. I'm hearing people that are like hate pumpkin, just being like, oh wow, okay, I thought this was gonna be a good movie.
Do you think pumpkins get a bad rep? Because I think, you know, they're quite a versatile food, aren't they? But I think they're often just felt to be, you know, yeah, you can make a pumpkin pie. But I think apparently lots of things you can do with, anyway.
I've never had a pumpkin pie. So I don't know if that's a British thing or whatever. Over here, we eat normal foods. So, I digress. My partner, actually, she's British. She comes from Southend, and
nice.
She moved down here when she was like 8. So she's very Australian, mm-hmm. but, she insists on me eating these Yorkshire puddings. And
what a treat. Yes.
Well, to her, yeah. To me, I'm just like, what is this tasteless nonsense? So sorry if that's sacrilege.
Yeah. Well, now I'm thinking, to bring it all full circle, I'm thinking of that great scene in The Gold Rush, of course, of Chaplin eating the boots or whatever it is. similar, but with a Yorkshire pudding, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, when she eats the Yorkshire pudding, she's eating the cheese on the sandwich. When I eat it, it's the soap on the sandwich. Yeah. to bring it back to the City Lights, I guess. Look, if someone has not seen City Lights, as you say, but they have enjoyed this podcast so much that they've stuck around to this point, it's obviously because they like the sound of your voice, Carl Sweeney. So where can they hear more of that?
Well, as you mentioned at the outset, I'm the host of the Movie Palace podcast, which is also part of the We Made This Network, which predominantly focuses on classics of the Hollywood cinema, with some exceptions, but usually it's a film from the 1960s or earlier, basically. So yeah, I've done quite a few episodes on that. I think 90 odd episodes at the time of recording, all sorts of stuff, westerns, gangster films, romantic comedies, all sorts, war films. So I would, if anyone hasn't heard that podcast but has enjoyed this episode with me, I would say find, you know, the list of episodes. There's bound to be something there that you have seen and are interested to listen about, hopefully. I'm on Twitter at CKJ Sweeney. The Movie Palace is on Twitter at Movie Palace Pod, also on Facebook and Instagram. But those are the main places to find me, really.
I can strongly recommend the Movie Palace. I am a fan. The most recent episode that I listened to was about the 400 Blows. Are you going to sort of branch into the French New Wave a little bit with a few, like, you know, Godard and a few other filmmakers?
Yeah, potentially. I've briefly discussed the possibility of doing Breathless with somebody not long ago. What I'm doing at the moment is trying to do a bit of a world tour. That was the intention behind doing the 400 Blows. I'm recording an episode soon on Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, the British film with Albert Finney, for example. So I always want to return to American cinema because that's the heart of the podcast. But just recently, I've been interested in doing films from a few other countries. So that's kind of been the impetus behind doing the 400 Blows and some stuff I've got coming up on the British New Wave. So, yeah.
Oh, if you get into Italian neorealism, let me throw my hand up. I'm keen.
Absolutely.
If people have enjoyed my voice, you can obviously hear me in other episodes of Movieversaries. This is the third episode on the We Made This Podcast Network. I'm also pop up on Real Talk a fair bit. I tend to pop up more around Oscar time, during like prestige films. So towards the end of the year or the start of the year, mid-year, I'm not so busy on that podcast. I'm also on a podcast called Pretty Fly, which is a 90s nostalgia podcast with my friend Daniel Lang. We've never met, by the way. We're both Australian people that have never met. So we just met online, which sounds weird, but anyway. We like to, trade experiences. He's more of a pop culture everyman. I'm more of a snob, I suppose. So one episode I'll get us both to watch Before Sunrise, you know, the Richard Linklater movie from the mid-90s. And then we talk about it the next episode, and then he will get me to watch Happy Gilmore. So then we've got to talk about that. And, you know, obviously I like Before Sunrise more. He likes Happy Gilmore for some reason. So, it sort of throws up some interesting ideas. So if you're into the 90s, may I recommend Pretty Fly, a 90s nostalgia podcast. Carl, thank you very, very much for joining me. It has been a distinct pleasure of mine to have you on the show.
Well, it's been a distinct pleasure of mine. Like I said, I think it's a great idea for a podcast. I think you've got off to a really good start with the Spirited Away episode that I heard. And yeah, no, it's a thrill of mine to be here for an early installment of Movieversary, so thank you, Bug.
Well, I'll have to get you back on here again when we do another one of those old movies that fall into your wheelhouse. I very much look forward to it. And thanks to everyone else who has tuned in. We very much hope you've enjoyed the show. If you have, please, if you'd be so kind, subscribe to Movieversaries and give us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. No pressure, of course. And if you intend on giving a one-star review, just don't. Movieversaries is a product of the We Made This Podcast Network. And if you've enjoyed this, there's a good chance you'll enjoy a bunch of our other shows, which you'll get a preview of in just a moment. If you want to help our network out, no pressure, of course, but please consider supporting us on Patreon by visiting patreon.com/wemadethis. Thanks again for your company, and see you for the next installment of Movieversaries.
Elsewhere on We Made This.
Free with this month's issue.
This is Fruit Tree and Red Flower Girl. This is a band that are so fucking difficult to Google, because they've got such a generic name. I was trying to Google Fruit Tree Metal Band and ended up with a load of results for like little metal bands to attach fruit trees to stick out and grow.
Oh, right. Send me a link to those.
The name being so generic, as I was doing my research, Esme from Hide From Time podcast had put up a post on Twitter about she was trying to do research for her forthcoming episode that she was doing, where there's a black metal band called Spiral Staircase. And she was trying to Google black metal spiral staircase and just getting black metal spiral staircases, which I thought was quite funny because it was exactly the same situation.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad someone else suffered the same pain as you.
Yes, absolutely.
They were fantastically on Casket, which is the record label that offered my old band the deal as well, and we did not take it.
Right in the childhood.
But what I will say is, I did like watching Hannah Montana the first or second time. When we had to watch the same episodes over and over again, that was when young Fraser was not very happy about that. For some reason, I've grown out of that. I'll rewatch stuff over and over again. Like, I can't count how many times I've watched How I Met Your Mother. But a younger Fraser did.
I can count how many times I've watched How I Met Your Mother.
Once.
Each episode, one time. And do you know how many times I intend to watch each episode?
Just once.
One time.
Real Talk. We Made This Movie Show.
You know, with all the water around, you know, like, we're in a noir. I want to see steaming streets, you know, have the streets with all this moisture. have that evaporating during the day and in the intense heat, like, you know, represent some of the stuff a little bit more visually, because, you know, it felt like she went halfway or three quarters of the way to a lot of this really cool stuff and didn't quite cross the finish line with some of it.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.